Okay, let's unpack this. We're diving deep today into some really fundamental but incredibly complex parts of being human. Morality, love, and happiness. And these sources you've shared, they make it so clear these aren't just, abstract ideas floating around.
No, not at all. They're deeply tied into our biology, our actual brains, and of course, the cultures we live in.
Right. And we might feel like we get them intuitively right. Morality, love.
Exactly. But when you really dig into the research, especially the neurobiology, the cultural studies, wow, it gets complicated fast.
Yeah.
We're talking about experiences shaped by brain dynamics so intricate you just can't boil them down to simple rules.
So that's our mission today, then, to
Yeah.
go through these sources, pull out the key insights, the important bits, and really explore the surprising connections and also the differences.
Yeah, how do these things show up, perhaps different brains, different culture?
And hopefully find some of those aha moments for
That's
you, help you see how these big ideas might connect to your own way of seeing the world, not just a list of facts.
Definitely. Keep it engaging.
Okay, let's start with morality. Is it just, following a
Yeah.
list, like the Ten Commandments, that sort of thing, or is it something deeper, more fluid?
Well, the sources strongly suggest it's much more fluid, more dynamic. I mean, look at how moral ideas evolve, even within just one tradition.
Like the Old Testament example.
Exactly. Jack Miles's analysis, looking at the Bible as literature, it shows this dramatic shift in how God is portrayed over, what, 1,000 years?
Yeah, from ordering terrible things, genocide even in the early parts.
Right, quite cruel depictions sometimes, then evolving towards a more loving figure as well as civilization itself developed.
Yeah.
It shows these ideas aren't set in stone. They change with us.
And it's hard to square some of those things within the same text, isn't it?
Yeah.
You pointed out the justification given for not wiping out tribes in Exodus because wild animals might take over,
Yeah.
and then comparing that to the really harsh penalties for sex stuff in Deuteronomy or Genesis, stoning. It's unbelievable that still happens some places.
It really highlights the problem of trying to pull universal, unchanging morals from ancient texts that clearly reflect shifting values and contain contradictions, which kind of leads us into how philosophers try to categorize morality. Your sources lay out three main ways.
Right. Okay. So first, there's virtue ethics. That's more about your internal character, right? Being a good person.
Yeah, a mix of intuition, reason, shaped by how you're raised, your beliefs. It's about who you are.
Then deontology. That's the
That's
duty-based one, following rules, obligations.
exactly. Moral laws. And interestingly, this seems linked to those fast emotional parts of the brain, like the amygdala for threat detection and the VMPFC, the ventromedial prefrontal cortex involved in social connection, our gut reactions, basically.
And the third one.
Consequentialism,
Yeah.
all about the outcomes. Utilitarianism is the big one here, maximizing the good for the most people.
That sounds more calculating.
It is. It takes more deliberate reasoning, involves a different brain area, the DLPFC, dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, planning, self-control.
But evolution didn't necessarily favor the calculating approach.
It seems not, or at least not primarily. The sources suggest evolution leaned toward those quicker social intuitions, the rule following, the deontological impulse. It makes sense for group cohesion, survival, faster than weighing every consequence.
And speaking of groups, the cultural differences are just huge, aren't they?
Yeah.
Especially around sex.
Oh, massive. You compare hunter-gatherer societies with agricultural ones, it's night and day.
Once you have property, inheritance.
Suddenly, knowing who the father is becomes critical. So you get this intense focus on monogamy, female virginity, fidelity, backed up by, as you said, incredibly harsh punishments.
But then you look elsewhere.
Right. Like Polynesia, where traditional morality apparently had almost nothing to say about sex in that way, no concept of premarital sin or affairs being inherently immoral.
Or that shared fatherhood idea in South America.
Yeah, where a child having multiple fathers was seen as beneficial because male mortality was high. They needed that communal support. Frans de Waal's quote is, "Great couples told to care for kids and manage jealousy about other partners. It's a completely different moral world."
It really makes something like the Ten Commandments seem very culturally specific. Only a few of them are actual crimes in most places today, right? Killing, stealing, perjury.
Pretty much. And even thou shalt not kill is incredibly complicated when you unpack it.
Yeah.
The Bible orders killing, sometimes mass killing. Then we debate self-defense, capital punishment, war.
Border defense, too. That must be a clash between thinking about the greater good for the nation versus a duty to help individuals suffering right there.
Exactly. Utilitarian versus deontological, right there. And then there's killing animals. Vegans say it's unethical. We have animal cruelty laws, but we also accept humane killing for food or research. it's messy.
So, simple universal rules just don't seem to hold up. What about the golden rule? Treat others as you want to be treated. That pops up everywhere.
It does, which is interesting in itself. But the sources show why it's not enough. It doesn't solve tricky dilemmas.
Right.
And it breaks down if you apply it literally to someone with totally different desires, like a masochist. Or worse, you end up imposing your values, assuming you know what's best for them.
Like that awful example from Australia with the Aboriginal children?
Tragically, yes. Thinking they were applying the golden rule, we'd want our kids to have these opportunities, but causing immense harm by ignoring the value of family and culture.
And the other big one, utilitarianism, maximum good. Sounds okay, but...
But then you hit the classic thought experiments like, is it okay to kill one healthy person to harvest their organs and save five others?
Ugh, no. Most people react strongly against that.
Exactly. DeWall points out it clashes with our deep loyalties. We naturally prioritize our own family, our group, over some abstract calculation for strangers. Evolution again, probably.
And Pinker's point about who the real benefactors are.
Yeah, that's provocative. Often it's the scientists developing vaccines or improving agriculture who save millions, maybe billions. Not the generals or kings we build statues of. It flips the consequentialist script a bit.
It really makes you think. So these moral ideas seem deeply rooted, maybe biologically, but also incredibly flexible.
There's evidence for deep roots. That Egyptian text you mentioned, 4,000 years old, advising a son to build a monument of love, not stone, do not kill.
Yet history is full of killing and tyranny.
And that phrase, opportunity makes a thief. It's true, isn't it? Police go on strike, looting breaks out. It shows that our internal compass is heavily influenced by external factors, social order, perceived risk.
Which brings us to neuroethics, studying the brain basis of morality.
Right, and the ethical issues from neuroscience. If we can change personality with brain stimulation, what does that mean? It forces us to confront that tension, brain determinism versus free will and responsibility.
Traditional ethics often ignored how people actually behave.
Exactly. It built abstract systems. But evolution, our social context, that's what shapes our sense of good and evil in the real world.
And cultural psychology adds that crucial layer about how our specific culture shapes us, especially challenging the weird bias.
No, Western, educated, industrialized, rich, democratic. Most research subjects fit that profile, but we can't assume their psychology is universal.
Richard Schwader's work you highlighted identifies different ethical foundations.
Right. The ethic of individual autonomy, big and weird cultures, an ethic of community group loyalty, tradition, which can sometimes curdle into nationalism, and an ethic of divinity, seeing morality tied to sacredness, purity, God.
And Haidt's moral matrix idea, we get locked into our culture's view.
It makes it hard to even see other perspectives as valid, which leads to his moral foundations theory.
The five or six foundations. Care harm.
Fairness cheating, loyalty betrayal, authority subversion, sanctity degradation, and later he added liberty oppression.
And these explain political divides.
To a large extent, yes. Liberals and conservatives tend to prioritize different foundations, so they react very differently to the same issue, immigration, taxes, whatever. Politicians tap into these different foundations to motivate their bases.
Okay, so stepping back, how does the brain actually do morality? Is there a moral spot?
No, not really a single spot. It's a network, a collaboration between reasoning and emotional areas.
Okay.
For those personal gut-wrenching dilemmas like the trolley problem, you see activation in areas like the VMPFC we mentioned, working with emotional hubs like the amygdala and the insula. The insula helps register that visceral bodily feeling of wrongness.
And for more abstract moral thinking.
That tends to engage the DLPFC more, the planning reasoning part. And understanding intentions, which is crucial for moral judgment, involves other areas like the superior temporal sulcus. It's a dynamic interplay.
Conformity plays a huge part too. We just want to fit in.
Deeply ingrained. Fear of rejection, social pressure. Evolutionarily vital for sticking with the group. That British sitcom Keeping Up Appearances.
Oh yeah, classic. Painfully accurate sometimes.
Absolutely. And then there's empathy. Feeling with others.
Mirror neurons are involved there, right?
Yeah, they're part of the system. Empathy helps us understand others' states, motivates helping behavior. At least for individuals we see suffering.
But it doesn't scale well. Seeing one suffering child versus statistics about millions.
Exactly. Our empathy system isn't really built for abstract, large-scale suffering. Neural studies, like Tanya Singer's work, show our brain activates similar pain areas when we see someone else hurt this effect of resonance.
But it's biased.
Hugely. Towards our in-group, the football fan study is a great example. Feeling empathy for your own team's fans, but actually feeling pleasure schadenfreude when a rival fan gets hurt.
Wow. So empathy isn't always purely good.
Not necessarily. And Richard Davidson's research suggests training compassion might be better. Compassion involves wanting to help alleviate suffering, activating positive emotion and motivation circuits, rather than just mirroring the negative feeling.
That's interesting. And it's important to differentiate empathy issues, like in autism.
Where it might be more about difficulty understanding others' mental states, theory of mind.
There's a psychopathy.
Right. Psychopaths often have theory of mind. They can understand what you're feeling intellectually. They just don't share the feeling. They lack the effective empathy. That's linked to differences in brain areas, like the orbitofrontal cortex.
Which leads to that really tough legal and ethical question.
Yeah.
If someone lacks that emotional response, are they less responsible for their crimes?
It's a huge debate. Fear of punishment might deter some, but maybe not severe psychopaths who don't feel fear the same way. Fields like neuroprowo or neurolaw are grappling with this. How does brain function relate to legal responsibility?
The sources also mention some oddities, like schadenfreude or chutzpah.
Yeah, that almost gleeful disregard for norms. Or sadism, which sometimes correlates with changes in the temporal lobe. And masochism. Evolution produced a huge range of inclinations.
So where does society draw the line? What do we punish? What do we tolerate? It gets really thorny when people start talking about biological predispositions.
Extremely thorny. And you mentioned the problematic arguments used by groups pushing to normalize things like pedophilia, often by redefining harm in ways that contradict overwhelming evidence. It shows how ideology can clash with data.
And actual brain damage, concussions, tumors can definitely change behavior,
yeah,
sometimes leading to crime.
Absolutely. It really underscores that old medieval ideas of just good and evil people aren't adequate. It's complex. Lawyers, psychiatrists, neuroscientists are all debating these implications.
What about free will in all this, if our brain influences us so much?
Well, most people who plan crimes know what's wrong, legally and often morally. Even if prefrontal damage reduces the emotional weight of consequences, the knowledge is often still there. The legal system generally assumes we have some capacity to control impulses, even if that capacity varies.
It's amazing how tiny things can nudge our choices, though. Word order in a survey.
Or framing taxes as offsets. Or metaphors crime as a virus versus a beast. It shapes how we think and feel subconsciously.
And that sense of fairness seems really basic, even in animals.
Yeah, the monkey's rejecting unequal rewards. It's tied to cooperation. You can't maintain a cooperative group if some members consistently take unfair advantage. Whether animals have morality like humans is debated, but fairness sensitivity is there.
Brain stimulation studies are wild, too. Zapping one area changes judgment from intentions to outcomes.
Young's 2010 study on the TPJ, yeah. Temporarily disrupting the area involved in thinking about others' thoughts made people judge accidents less harshly if the intention was bad but the outcome was okay.
And stimulating another area, the PMFC, could change core beliefs.
Holbrook, 2015. It could increase religious fundamentalism or prejudice. Suggests even deeply held beliefs have a neural basis that can be influenced. Scary stuff, really.
Fairness shows up in those economic games, too, like the ultimatum game. People rejecting unfair money.
Right. Even if it costs them. They're punishing unfairness, enforcing a social norm, often driven by emotion, not calculation.
And the cheating studies. Some people cheat easily, some resist with effort, some just don't seem tempted.
Exactly. Different brain activity patterns. The ACC lights up when there's conflict, like resisting temptation. For others, there's less conflict, either because they cheat readily or because they just aren't inclined to.
So all this biology and brain science, it's trying to naturalize morality, connect philosophy to how we actually work.
That's the idea. Thinkers like Churchland, DeWall, bridging that gap between abstract ethical theories and the biological evolved creatures we are. Hume's is an ought problem.
And cultural evolution shapes our brains too, not just our ideas.
Henrik's weird thesis makes that case powerfully. Things like the church's marriage roles changing kinship structures over centuries.
Leading to more individualism in the West.
Potentially, yes.
Yeah.
And Protestant emphasis on literacy driving brain specialization for reading. Culture literally sculpts the brain through neuroplasticity over generations.
Social neuroscience, neuropolitics. finding brain differences linked to political views.
Yeah, correlations between, say, amygdala size or ACC activity and liberal conservative leanings. And trying to change someone's politics often backfires, just digs them in deeper.
Those huge global studies on moral dilemmas, the trolley problems.
Yeah.
What do they find?
Some broad consistencies, like saving humans over animals, but also real cultural differences.
Like the Kuna people being more utilitarian.
In some scenarios, yes. Different countries cluster together in their responses. Some cultures weigh social status more heavily when choosing who to save.
Which is exactly what self-driving cars will have to do, right? Make programmed moral choices.
I mean, massive ethical challenge. Program for the local culture's average view. Or some universal principle. Who decides?
The dyadic theory tries to tie this together. Morality as perceived harm.
Essentially, yeah. Morality centers on an agent intentionally harming a victim. But crucially, what counts as harm is culturally defined. It can be physical, emotional, symbolic.
Explains things like microaggressions, or why judging historical figures is hard.
Exactly. Their definition of harm might have been totally different. It triggers our intuitive harm detection circuits based on our cultural lens.
And virtue ethics comes back in, focusing on character, striving for eudaimonia, nirvana.
Right, those states of flourishing or enlightenment, internal cultivation rather than just rules or outcomes seen across different traditions.
And finally, that tricky area of genetics, environment, group differences.
The sources emphasize variation within any population is vast, way bigger than average differences between populations. Focusing on averages for things like IQ or empathy is scientifically problematic and historically dangerous.
Used to justify nationalism, racism.
Precisely. The real focus should be fostering empathy and understanding individual differences, not promoting group superiority myths.
Wow. Okay, that was a lot on morality, brains, culture, evolution, self-driving cars. Let's shift gears to maybe something equally complex, love.
Yeah, love. And again, the sources show it's not just one thing. The Greeks had it more figured out, maybe.
With the different types. Sexus, storge.
Philia for friendship. Eros for that passionate romantic drive. Agape for unconditional, selfless love. It acknowledges the different flavors.
And evolution needed love, didn't it? For us humans.
Seems like it. Our upright posture meant narrower birth canals, which meant helpless babies. Really helpless for a long time.
So we needed long-term care, pair bonding.
Cooperation. Absolutely essential for raising those vulnerable kids. And maybe later, as groups got bigger, religion helped create bonds beyond just family. Shared devotion, creating a kind of love or loyalty.
Neurochemically, it's a cocktail, right? Hormones, yeah. Neurotransmitters.
A whole soup. Mm-hmm. And brain imaging studies show fascinating things, comparing romantic and maternal love, for instance.
They activate similar reward areas?
Yes, specific but also overlapping reward circuits, areas rich in receptors for oxytocin and vasopressin, the bonding hormones.
And love shuts down negative stuff.
Yeah.
Judgment.
It seems to dampen activity in areas linked to negative emotion, fear, social judgment like the amygdala, helps you focus intensely on the loved one, maybe ignore their flaws, especially early on. Zeki's work and others you cited show these patterns.
Maybe that's why that early romantic high is so indescribable. It's an unusual brain state.
Pretty unusual, yeah. High dopamine, the wanting chemical. But sometimes low serotonin, oddly enough, similar to OCD patterns, intense focus, maybe obsession. Nerve growth factor levels even correlate with romantic intensity.
Like the prairie voles, the classic example.
Right, monogamous prairie voles versus their promiscuous cousins. The difference is linked to vasopressin receptors, dopamine, and specific brain reward areas. You block those receptors, you can block the pair bonding. Biology matters.
The culture matters hugely, too.
Uh-huh.
Romantic love as the basis for marriage is pretty recent, historically. Speaking.
Relatively, yeah. Arranged marriages are still common globally, and the satisfaction rates aren't necessarily lower. Love is sometimes expected to grow after the marriage, not before. Different script entirely.
And animals. Can they love? We see attachment.
Strong attachment, absolutely. Albatross pairs finding each other after months apart, but calling it love in the human sense with our complex consciousness and language, we just don't know their subjective experience. We see the behavior.
Okay, so from morality and love, let's move to the third big one, happiness. Another slippery concept. How do we even define it?
Well, it's not just pleasure, right? Hedonia. There's also that deeper sense of meaning, fulfillment, eudaimonia, and flow, being totally absorbed in something.
People try to measure it, though. happiness indices surveys.
Yeah, the World Database of Happiness, Bhutan's Gross National Happiness, lots of attempts, but it's fundamentally subjective.
And our memory plays tricks on us. Kahneman's work.
Duration neglect, exactly. We remember the peaks and the end, not the average feeling over time.
And that study tracking moods with phones, mind wandering, makes us less happy.
Surprisingly, yes. Even pleasant mind wandering. The big takeaway was that what you're thinking about seems to impact your happiness more in the moment than what you're actually doing. Presence matters.
Neurobiologically, it's the reward system again. Dopamine, serotonin.
Endorphins too, yeah. But it's complex. There's wanting dopamine-driven seeking versus liking the actual pleasure involving other pathways, these hedonic hotspots.
And you can't just keep pushing the pleasure button indefinitely.
No, the system gets saturated. Long-term happiness seems more tied to overall balance, health, temperament, optimism, your life situation, not just constant highs.
So what can people actually do? Your sources mention things like that Yale course, Mon Gaudat's book.
Right, practical approaches. Gaudat's simple idea. Happiness equals reality minus expectations.
So it's about managing your thoughts about reality.
Largely, yes. Events happen, but it's our interpretation, our internal chatter that often causes the suffering. Adjusting expectations, managing that inner voice.
And just to circle back quickly, AI understanding morality. The moral Turing test.
Yeah, fascinating and slightly unnerving stuff. People sometimes judging AI's moral reasoning as more sound than a human's in certain tests. What does that mean?
So wrapping this up, we've covered a huge amount of ground from your sources. Mm-hmm. Morality, love, happiness, seeing how they're all tangled up with our brains, our evolution, our cultures.
Yeah, it's been quite a journey. From ancient texts, philosophy, right through to brain scans, cultural studies, animal behavior, even AI. It really shows these core human things are anything but simple or universal.
Looking closely at all the details you brought together, hopefully it gives you some real insights into why we feel and act and believe the way we do, and just how much variety there is under the surface.
It absolutely highlights the layers of complexity, doesn't it? Things we think are straightforward often aren't.
Which leaves us with a final question for you to chew on. Thinking about all these deep biological and cultural forces shaping our morals, our love lives, our happiness. Mm-hmm. How much real control, how much agency do we actually have in defining and living these things?
Mm-hmm.
And what does acknowledging all this complexity mean for how we understand ourselves?
Mm.
And maybe just as importantly, how we try to understand other people.